and welcome to Banfield. For the first time since the first week of October 2001, the U.S. does not have a military presence in Afghanistan. And we can tell you the Taliban are celebrating that. Fireworks over Hamid Karzai Airport, the international airport in Kabul, after five successive plane loads of U.S. troops took to the skies and brought to a close a war in which the Taliban were quite often down but never out, and never less than a clear and present danger to Americans. Tonight, of course, the Taliban are in complete control of their country, a spokesperson calling it full independence. And by the U.S. government's estimates, a couple hundred Americans are still there, though the government says it is holding the Taliban to their promise of allowing safe passage out of the country. It will now be up to the State Department to talk them out. And while it's probably far too soon to look far into the future, we do have one ominous sign tonight. The former chief of security for Osama bin Laden is back in Afghanistan near Tora Bora on the Pakistani border. And with that, let us bring in our guest tonight. Wesley Clark is a former NATO Supreme Allied Commander whose scores of awards and decorations include the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Sebastian Junger is an author, journalist, and a filmmaker who has covered Afghanistan in print and on film. And we want to thank you both for being here. First, General Clark, I want to start with you. The longest war is set to be over. What are your initial thoughts?
Well, first of all, we've been losing this war for a long, long time. If you measured it by could we democratize and pacify Afghanistan, we went into it without a strong plan for the purpose of the war. It was really a war of revenge, of punishment. And President Bush said he wanted Osama bin Laden. He never even directed the military commander to get a plan to take Osama bin Laden. The military commander on the ground was distracted by Secretary Rumsfeld wanting to invade Iraq. And he was also concerned that he didn't want to put additional American troops at risk. So Osama bin Laden skated over the border to Pakistan, where, as you know, we got him in 2011.
You know, there's
almost
so much.
Turned away from Afghanistan and started preparing to invade Iraq as early as the spring of 2002. I was getting told by my former British colleagues and others, they were going to Florida to the Central Command to prepare for the invasion of Iraq. We never focused on that mission. And we put in a troop surge. Then we announced that we were going to pull it out again after 18 months as though there was some magic of putting an extra 50,000, 40,000 troops in there and leaving them for 18 months. No, it's a constant series of misjudgments and problems, the biggest of which, Ashley, is that we never dealt effectively with Pakistan. The basic rule of counterinsurgency is if you don't isolate the theater of operations from outside support, you don't succeed. The Taliban was a creation, or at least a full instrument, of Pakistan's Inner Services Intelligence Agency. And I'm sure in Pakistan, they're very happy right now.
Well, we've heard about some of these historic landmark decisions that led us to this day. But I have to bring in Sebastian now, Sebastian Junger. You've covered this story for years in documentaries and films. Some of us are asking here in America, should we have expected anything different than how this played out?
Yeah, well, first of all, I completely agree with the general on every word that he said. And, you know, what I would add is that when I was in Afghanistan in 1996, the Taliban were poised to take over. I was in Kabul. And what I heard from people was that they hated the Taliban, but they were going to let them take over because the Taliban promised to clean up corruption. And the Najibullah government was unbelievably corrupt. And the Taliban hung him from a light post when they took Kabul because of his corruption. And when we went in there, the one thing we never addressed was the systemic corruption in Afghan society. And we pumped $2 trillion worth of American money in there, which obviously amplified that corruption enormously. And we never dealt with it. We never monitored payments to governors for development projects. They pocketed half the money. I mean, the corruption was just endless. And it was the one thing that the Afghans wanted out of this. And we just did. We studiously ignored it. And so I think, no, the outcome wasn't inevitable. I think the outcome was inevitable given our mistakes and blunders. But had we not made those, I think there could have been a different outcome today.
Can I jump in with Sebastian?
First of all, Sebastian,
you've done a marvelous job covering. I've read your books. You've done tremendous work there. Thank you for that. Look, this is Central Asia. These people know how to survive. Graft and corruption is the way they survive. That's not corrupt by their standards. There was never an Afghanistan. The king had his warlords. They paid each other off. Loyalty was bought. It was maintained by continuing funding. And the United States just added to it. Then we put our troops in there. They don't speak the language. They don't know the culture. We had these very idealistic standards. It's a shame. But I want to say this. I really admire and respect the men and women who served there and sacrificed there.
Right.
And we owe them a tremendous debt of gratitude. And whatever we say about the failure, the fact remains is eventually we did get Osama bin Laden. And we did, to some extent, force al-Qaeda to metastasize and become something different. And we haven't been attacked. Okay, maybe it wasn't a direct, but 20 years, we put a lot of effort into anti-terrorism and counterterrorism. We're much better prepared, I believe, to defend ourselves now than we were when we went into this mission.
Can I ask you something about what you just said earlier, though, about culture? And the language is part of the problem. The optics of this is that we are looking at it through an American lens and we're not seeing how deals are brokered in Afghanistan in a completely different way than they would be done here with U.S. soldiers.
Sure, that's true. But actually, maybe, some of the people that run this country and that are diplomats and so forth, they don't understand the way deals are done in America. I live in the South. Look, people scratch each other's back. People know what's happening. The people on the inside, the people that want to make money off real estate, they know the people on the city council. Maybe their kids are married to them. Maybe they talk at a barbecue on the weekend. Maybe they say, gee, we're trying to get this new road in around the airport. Maybe somebody says, gee, I know how to get that land. And, they don't know what I know. That's the way the world works. It's just that, in our legalistic, idealistic way in America, where we think everything should be perfect, everything should be by competitive bid, and there should be no hanky-panky going on. Well, we don't live that way, and we didn't know how to deal with it in Afghanistan, especially given the fact that it wasn't just systemic corruption, but it was also score settling. It's a tribal and family culture, and people have issues with certain other tribes and certain other families. And the Americans were brought in and got in the middle of this. You stole my bicycle. He stole my bicycle, boss. Do something to him. You don't know when the guy is speaking to you whether he stole a bicycle or not. And we put the military out there to do things the military is not trained to do. Mm-hmm. That's not what militaries do. Lieutenants do not teach nation building. They don't know how city council really operates. Maybe a great image of him sitting around wisely with Ashura legs crossed and drinking tea and explaining democracy. But the lieutenant is not the right person to do that. If we were really serious about that, we would have had an entirely different set of programs there.
Right.
And an entirely different group of people.
Well, let's talk about the fact that the U.S. says that it's not over for the involvement watching over Afghanistan. Listen to this. This is the head of U.S. Central Command.
The military phase of this operation has ended. The diplomatic sequel to that will now begin. And I believe our Department of State is going to work very hard to allow any American citizens that are left, and we think the citizens that were not brought out number in the low, very low hundreds. I believe that we're going to be able to get those people out. I think we're also going to negotiate very hard and very aggressively to get our other Afghan partners out.
Okay, so General Clark, the word that jumps out there is negotiate. What does that mean? And what does that mean for Americans and Afghans who didn't get out?
Well, it means we're going to work really hard to try to get people out by hook and by crook. I mean, there's thousands of people, tens of thousands of people that want to get out and need to get out. I mean, we're hearing from people right now, tonight, hiding in their attics. They were trying to get to some airfield. They couldn't get out. The Taliban were there. Their bribes didn't work. Something collapsed. Look, people are living in fear there. Now, you can't see it here in the United States. It looks pretty normal. We're going to restaurants and it's a normal evening. You can watch television. Just imagine those people who know they're on a hit list. And they were supposed to get picked up, but they didn't get picked up. And the aircraft were supposed to take them, but they didn't take them. And they didn't want to leave too soon. And now they are worried. So we've got an enormous challenge ahead. This is like the Dunkirk relief operation in World War II. This is 1,000 boats leaving the coast of England trying to get to France to pick up soldiers. In this case, it's a bunch of well-meaning people in the United States and Europe hiring aircraft, hiring people to go in on the ground, identifying people using code names, cell phones, texts, messages. It's an incredible effort, and it's not over.
Sebastian, I want to bring you in because obviously a lot of us saw the headlines, the Pentagon investigating reports of a drone strike that happened on Sunday, and it apparently killed civilians, killed children. Again, you covering the war, all of the signposts that we're seeing right now. Is this a legacy that America is signing up for? Is there anything about this narrative that we need to know from those who've been on the ground?
Well, that drone strike seems to have been against some suicide bombers who were probably headed to the airport. The last time they hit the airport, they killed a couple hundred people. So it's the kind of calculation the military makes all the time. You know, do we risk a strike and risk killing some civilians, preventing a larger damage? I mean, I don't know what was inside their thinking, but I'm guessing it was something like that. What's interesting to me about that is it seems, I don't know where the intelligence for that strike would have come from, except from the Taliban. I don't know where that intel came from. And it would be, if it did come from the Taliban, that was passed on to the U.S. military that then acted on it, it would be a really interesting example of a collaboration, a cooperation between the Taliban, who we fought for 20 years, and the U.S. military. I mean, it sort of raises the question, like, what was the flow of information there? Frankly, the common enemy in Afghanistan right now is ISIS. I mean, ISIS did unspeakable things in Syria for several years before they were finally all but eradicated. They would do the same thing in Afghanistan. And, I'm really wondering if it, and I'm not saying this is a good thing or a bad thing, but I'm really wondering at some point if we might not see American airstrikes conducted to support Taliban troops on the ground fighting ISIS. I mean, I don't know, but I can sort of imagine it a little bit.
Yeah, well, you give a lot of good perspective because, again, it was the U.S. finding a credible threat inside a vehicle where there were reportedly two suicide bombers. There was another strike similarly on Saturday where they say that two suicide bombers were taken out. And it was to protect the activity and the people who were at the Kabul airport. So I know that we're going to continue to talk about the ISIS threat. And if that is the common enemy, from both the U.S.'s perspective as well as the Taliban, as history has painted a picture for us. But, gentlemen, General Clark, Sebastian Younger, we really do appreciate you joining us tonight. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for your work and service to our country. Up next, we will take a look at the Afghan war through the eyes of a soldier who fought it and a journalist who almost died covering it, plus the threat of ISIS-K. Next. Welcome back. Tonight, the U.S. is officially entirely out of Afghanistan. The U.S. military is for sure. A couple hundred or so American civilians are still in the country. Prospects for leaving are currently unknown. We want to welcome more guests tonight, Danny Seisler, an Afghanistan combat vet who was awarded the Bronze Star while serving with a special ops task force in 2016, and Carmen Gentile, journalist, author, and himself an Afghan war casualty in the event that he actually suffered an injury, a crushed skull, in a Taliban rocket-propelled grenade attack in 2010. Glad to have you both with us with your unique perspectives. First thing, I just feel like, and I'm going to start with you, Danny, the ISIS threat and what ISIS-K is, this unique affiliate that is now setting off suicide bombs in the area where these precious Afghan civilians were threatened and in some cases killed. How big of a threat is ISIS-K to Afghanistan and to the U.S.?
So right now, I would say ISIS-K is a major threat to Afghanistan. What the attack in Kabul really was lethal propaganda for ISIS. They're battling for control of the country with the Taliban. And what's important to know is the Taliban and ISIS-K are sworn enemies of each other. As far as a threat to the United States goes, ISIS-K isn't there yet. But if we look at where the Islamic State was in ISIS in Iraq and Syria, even a few years ago, and we saw how quickly they were able to gain momentum, I think we're going to see ISIS-K head in that direction. Certainly with the attack on the airport, they are going to gain followers left and right, and hopefully not, but are trending in the direction of posing a threat to the United States.
Carmen, I want to bring you in here. What are your thoughts surrounding not only this threat of terrorists being harbored here in Afghanistan after U.S. Left, the U.S. military is leaving, but also what is your thought about did we fail or did we succeed in our mission?
We know earlier this week I wrote a piece asking just this question, who won the war in Afghanistan? And I break it down by all the protagonists in this epic two-decade tragedy that's unfolded. So I ask the question, did the Americans win the war in Afghanistan? After 20 years of blood and sacrifice by men and women who've lost their lives, lost limbs, and their families who've made the supreme sacrifices at home, we can't say that America won this war in Afghanistan. So did the Afghan people win this war in Afghanistan? The Afghan civilians caught in the middle of this two-decade-long tragedy. Well, clearly half the population, the women, are now going to be subjected to unspeakable horrors at the hands of the Taliban. They clearly did not win. So let's look. Did the Taliban win this war? Yes. Right now, they're celebrating. They're firing fireworks and machine guns in the air at the Hamid Karzai Airport, celebrating what they call a win. But what have they won? You know, instantly, now that they've taken over, three-quarters of their GDP is gone because a lot of that came by through federal aid. What are they going to do? How are they going to run this country now that many of their best and brightest are fleeing for the exits? Have they won the war? What have they won? So, yeah, I can't say that they're a winner either. So let's look at ISIS-K. They're a threat now. They've clearly established themselves as someone that the U.S. and the Taliban have to worry about. Yet they were targeted twice since attacking the airport. Are they the winners of the war in Afghanistan? No. What this amounts to is that we've all been losers in this war. And it's a sad, tragic comedy, like I mentioned, that's two decades in the making. And it's a comedy that we ourselves helped write.
I wanted to ask you about your perspective because you mentioned, you know, the fact that we're all nobody really has attained anything and the best and brightest leaving the country. Is it that the Taliban is still the cruel organization that it was 20 years ago? And that's just point blank period. Is it that they are hurt or offended that their best and brightest are leaving the country they should have national pride for America and for other countries, almost 100 of them all over the world who are harboring or receiving these refugees? Are they just offended and hurt?
Offended and hurt because people see them for who they are? Yeah, they're exactly the same. This PR campaign they have, in the run-up to Kabul is just that. They are the exact same organization. There have been reports in their march to the Capitol of them mutilating the bodies of soldiers as calling cards to let them know that, hey, if you try to stand up to us in the final battle for Kabul, this is the same fate for you. They are the exact same organization they were in 20 years ago. Now they just have a level of sophistication in terms of their communication vis-a-vis the internet and other means by which they use to subjugate their people. But no, they are the exact same organization. We're going to see the exact same results. Women are going to suffer greatly in Afghanistan. I see this. There's nothing different. No, not at all.
Danny, do you buy that the Taliban has promised foreigners who want to leave the ability to leave if they have the proper travel documents, or those who, again, like American citizens, the couple hundred that are still there, reportedly, according to the U.S. government, do you believe that they will hold on to that promise and actually follow through with it?
I am deeply concerned for the Americans that are still in Afghanistan. No, I don't trust the Taliban. I don't take them at their word. That's the first thing that comes to mind when I think that the United States has left Afghanistan. Afghanistan is there are a few hundred Americans. The Taliban capture, they hold people for ransom. That is something that we saw them do frequently. That is part of their playbook. So I am deeply, deeply concerned for the Americans that are left.
We've certainly heard a lot of stories just in the past couple of weeks of seemingly senseless deaths, killings of people for no particular reason at all, persecutions by religious minorities. Let's listen to what the Secretary of State said late today.
As of today, we've suspended our diplomatic presence in Kabul and transferred our operations to Doha, Qatar, which will soon be formally notified to Congress. Given the uncertain security environment and political situation in Afghanistan, it was the prudent step to take.
Was the step prudent and effective? Do either of those words even equate to what we've seen? Carmen, I'll start with you.
Well, I think it was General Mattis, and I'm going to paraphrase him previously, who said that when the State Department doesn't do their job, he has to, you know, step in and do more. And that requires more bullets by him and less diplomacy. That's a problem. Yeah, this is going to be a problem. Not having eyes on the ground in the diplomatic corps in Afghanistan is going to be problematic. I can see why ideologically we don't want to give credence to the Taliban by recognizing them as the government. The last time they were in charge, there were three nations that recognized them: Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and the UAE. It's going to be interesting to see how all this shakes out. Who's going to be recognizing the Taliban? Will China? Will Russia? Will Iran? You know, their diplomatic missions are still ongoing there. So what's it going to look like in the future? Are they going to look to seek out international recognition? They didn't last time, so I'm not sure they will this time either.
Danny, your final thoughts, just in terms of, you know, having served in Afghanistan, being there on the ground, what do you think the next steps are for the U.S. government? We've seen those drone strikes this weekend.
Sure. We went to Afghanistan when I was 9 years old. The point of going was to keep America safe from terrorist attacks based in Afghanistan. I would have to hope that we are still going to take measures to ensure that Afghanistan doesn't become a safe haven for attacks against the United States from Al-Qaeda, from ISIS-K. That is why we went there. That is why we shed so much American blood. That is why my brothers and sisters sacrificed so much. So whatever we do, I hope and pray that we continue to take measures to keep Americans safe.
Thank you so much, Carmen Gentile, Danny Seisler. Thank you guys again. And of course, the sentiments that you just spoke of, a lot of Americans are wishing the same and thanking our service members, especially those who've paid the ultimate price. Straight ahead, a young Afghan who has been studying in America for years and worries for the family left behind. Welcome back. Tonight, with the last U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, the longest war in our history finally over there. There's no precise number of American civilians still in the country. We know it's around a couple hundred for the Americans. Nowhere near a precise estimate of Afghan interpreters, though, or contractors or other allies who want to get out. My next guest is an Afghan student studying right here in Chicago who has concerns about where his family is now. Kahan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Adrian. Thank you for having me.
You've been here in the States for 4 years studying.
That's correct.
Yeah. But you were born and raised in Kabul.
17 years, born and raised.
So almost the entire time of when the U.S. Army, actually the U.S. military, was occupying Afghanistan, you grew up seeing American soldiers. What was life like for you as a child?
Well, I grew up, I started out of school at just a typical public school. Mm-hmm. And then my dad had this dream of providing the best education for his kids, you know, every good father should have. Mm-hmm. And then he enrolled us to the International School of Kabul. And that was a school that was sponsored by Americans. Staff members and teachers there were Americans. Mm-hmm. And then I went there from second grade up until 10th grade.
Wow.
And then that closed down because of threats from Taliban and ISIS. And so after that closed down, because I'd been studying in English in most of my life, I had to look for options over here. And so I started applying to schools, And then after 2 years of searching for schools and financial arguments with my parents about, you know, how am I going to make it here, a school in Wisconsin gave me a good scholarship. I was able to come over here, and I've been studying at Lake Forest College for the past 4 years.
Well, congratulations to you for continuing your studies. I'm sure your family's very proud. Have you been able to talk with them? Because they actually were able to get out on one of those flights from Kabul airport.
From what I know. So okay. When Kabul fell, two Sundays ago, when Kabul fell, I've been in touch with my parents trying to figure out ways. Our first plan was to get them out of the country as soon as possible, no matter what happens. And our first plan was to get them in Pakistan, just a close neighboring country, just out of the borders and out of Taliban control. But my youngest brother, who also attended the same school I did, there's a family in Nebraska that said there's a small group of ISK students, International School of Kabul students, that are at the airport. And if you guys stick together, maybe the military will spot you. And after 3 and 4 nights of being at the airport, you know, being in the crowd, shoving and pushing through the crowd and trying to get the military's attention, I get a voice message from my mom at 4 a.m., I think last Thursday. And all she said was it was a short message. And she said that she was next to a plane that made it through the crowd and they were boarding. But I haven't heard from them since.
Wow.
But according to protocol, they should be in Germany right now.
So what are your thoughts? I mean, how are you fearful? Are you worried? Are you, you know, using your studies as a distraction from what could or might have happened?
Well, I am anxious, but the fact that I got that voice message is reassurance.
Yeah.
I think the fact that they haven't been contacted might be a good thing. They might be through screening. They might be through some kind of background check or whatever process the refugees have at this point. So maybe they don't have access to Wi-Fi. But the only reassuring thing I have is that voice message that says that, you know, we're next to a plane and we're boarding. Mm-hmm. So I think they got out. I hope they got out, but I think they got out.
When you heard about the blast, the suicide bomber who killed so many people there at the airport, what were your first thoughts?
Well, the morning that I got the message from my mom, I was bawling. I was just crying. But then I hear about that, and then it gets me worried because it was already 4 or 5 hours later,
right,
after I got the voice message, I hear about the explosions. And so just I get chills all over my body, and I try and contact them, and I can't contact them. But I still haven't been able to this day. But I just think they're out. Otherwise, I would have heard something.
What about your other family that's there in Kabul that didn't get out?
Well, all my extended family, they tried, but they're still there. You know, as we know, yesterday or today at 3 p.m. was the last flight out of Kabul. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure there's still Americans there. There's still allies that have helped Americans that are still stuck there. So I don't know what other avenues they have to pursue to get out of Kabul, mm-hmm. but their lives are in danger. They are in threat.
Put us in the shoes of a young Afghan boy who has seen the threat of the Taliban and ISIS I'm really up close in terms of you and your family know that you had to get out or get to safety, have a better life. What's your perspective when you watch these news stories, when you watch our reporting?
Well, I was fortunate enough to grow up. I was born in 1999 and the totalitarian control of Taliban ended in 2001. But I was fortunate to grow up in a normal government without Taliban rule, even though, you know, we still had attacks. We still had battles. We still had little proxy wars here and there. Mm-hmm. And there were suicide bombers in Kabul all the time. Mm-hmm. So life in Afghanistan, life in Kabul was never guaranteed. You know, me and my dad would get into small arguments because I would like to go to like events, local events in the city. But he said that stay away. Crowded people means danger. You know, too much population means danger. So life in Kabul, as just growing up, we just had to be aware of where we went. Mm-hmm. I'm not exaggerating when I say there's no guarantee that you'll make it back home safely. Mm-hmm. But right now, under Taliban control, there is no guarantee and no prediction of anything.
Your family, what was the main threat to your family? I mean, we've heard about the Taliban killing people because of Sharia law, mm-hmm. because people broke the law. It could be for a petty crime or it could be for something more serious. We've heard stories of women and how they've been treated there, as well as religious minorities. What was it that your family feared the most from groups like the Taliban?
Well, my father, he translated for the International Red Cross during the Taliban regime. While the Red Cross was there, he was an interpreter, and he was affiliated with foreigners, and that's obviously just forbidden according to Taliban. That immediately means a death threat, a death sentence. But even like other aspects of our life, like my father, like typically women in Afghanistan, the past 20 years have been revolutionary, but still, women's rights are still not where they should be in Afghanistan. But yet my mom was an English teacher. You know, my dad was very open-minded, very liberal in thought. My mom was an English teacher, you know, and he didn't have like any negative thoughts about that. But now the Taliban are there because my mom teaches a foreign language, a language of the infidels, according to what they say, because I have taught at multiple educational centers, because my dad has been a translator. My dad just recently got unemployed of his interpreting job at the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, because what they stand for is human rights, and a big portion of that is women's rights. And women being equal is something the Taliban can't stand. Mm. It's against their thoughts, against their beliefs.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like they say they've changed, but from a lot of what we've heard.
I think what they say right now is because the world has their eyes on them. I think after the cameras are gone, we will see history repeated what it was 20 years ago.
Well, I hope your family doesn't see history repeated around it. I hope that they remain safe and that your entire family that's in, hopefully, Germany is safe as well.
I also, too. I'm happy for my family, and we can only pray for the others at this point.
Yes.
Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you, Kahan, for being with us. Thanks for making the time. Still to come, 1 million Americans without power tonight after Hurricane Ida pummeled Louisiana. A live report from the state coming up next.
No lights, no water in the hotel, nothing. Just broke loose.
I honestly knew that we probably should leave, but I wasn't going to leave them to fend for themselves.
This is unbelievable, something I've never seen before.
This is going to be a very long ordeal in terms of getting everything cleaned up and certainly getting everything repaired.
This is in the midst of tragedy. This is in the midst of COVID. Nearly 1 million people without power in Louisiana tonight. Officials say it will not be restored anytime soon. That includes the entire city of New Orleans. Yesterday, Hurricane Ida made landfall as a Category 4 storm. Winds of 150 miles per hour, one of the strongest storms to hit the region since Hurricane Katrina in 2005. It's now weakened to a tropical depression located about 20 miles north of Jackson, Mississippi. But as you heard just moments ago, authorities are in life-saving mode right now, and it's not going to be easy. Roads are blocked, down trees, debris, 2,000 miles of power lines are out of commission across the state, and all of the cell phone companies have reported some kind of outage. Marky Martin is in New Orleans telling us what the conditions are like tonight.
Good to join you this evening. Right now, we're standing in front of what has been the worst storm damage that we have found in New Orleans. This pile of bricks, this pile of rubble right behind me, this was once a very famous record store. This was a jazz record shop that Louis Armstrong worked at for a period of time. He frequented here when he would come back to town. This, we're told, really became a second home for him. I'm going to step out of the way just so you can see what's left behind me here. Really sad to see the destruction that Hurricane Ida left behind. Also to the left of this pile of rubble, you can also see a mural that was of popular jazz musician Buddy Bolden and his band. So this is really a corner that means a lot to New Orleans. It's culture, it's music, it's beloved, and now it's gone. Now, all in all, though, New Orleans fared pretty well. Lots of trees down, broken glass, of course, still no power to most of the city. In fact, about 1 million Louisianans still without power tonight. New Orleans is completely black. But it did fare well. It's a completely different story for communities that are surrounding New Orleans. You go about an hour southwest to a little community called Houma, Louisiana. And we spoke to some people there. There is destruction everywhere. It's though a bomb went off. But we spent the afternoon with several people there today, many of whom said, I have ridden storms out my entire life and I'll never do it again. Take a listen.
I have my three grandchildren with me. The oldest one is 6. I was scared for their lives. Everything blowing all over the place, raining inside the house, no more shingles on the roof.
We don't need to worry about the material things or anything like that. We have life, we have the energy, we have the ability, so we'll rebuild, put it back together again.
Yeah, their resiliency here in Louisiana just goes unmatched. Now, to see the devastation in person, it's just a completely different story. But in fact, there are a lot of areas today that we couldn't even gain access to because rescue crews are already working. They're in full force, all hands on deck. Saw a few different rescues today in person, but certainly a long road ahead for Louisianans. And in terms of power, everyone's being told to wait at least 3 to 4 weeks for those lights to come back on.
Marky Barton, thank you so much for your reporting. We're joined now by somebody at the center of the rescue efforts in Louisiana. Todd Terrell is the president of the United Cajun Navy. This is a 501c3. We've seen you all at work in the waters at storms like this. Unfortunately, it's too reminiscent of Hurricane Katrina. Thanks so much for being with us. We have to ask you whether the United Cajun Navy is out on the Cajun Bayou in Lafourche Parish. We've heard that there are significant power outages, damage. What have you guys seen there?
Well, you know, Terrebonne and Lafourche was pretty destructed. We had guys that started at 1 o'clock this morning, and they actually worked their way about 6 miles to help start clearing the roads. It's just devastating. Everywhere you look is just destruction. You know, and then you go a little bit east, and the flood in La Place. So we have two different types of what we're looking at. One of them is more of a wind issue, and the other one was flooding. But it's pretty total destructive down there.
How do you know where to look?
Pretty much you just look anywhere. You know, you see roofs off, you know, trees down, power lines down,
okay.
And there's subdivisions where we just go door to door. Some areas are kind of rural a little bit, so
it's
you
okay.
have to go a little bit further.
So you want me to hop off? Or okay. I apologize, Todd. We're getting some audio.
Okay, no problem.
Possibly from another guest that was having some technical difficulties, so we apologize to our viewers right now. But, you know, I'm thinking about this, and we have seen so much devastation in the past year and a half. When it comes to this kind of a story, it might be easy for some people to tune out. You know, it's just too much. What would you say to those who don't live anywhere near New Orleans, don't live anywhere near Louisiana, but are watching these images on television? You know, put us in your place. Give some sense of what kind of compassion is needed for these folks.
You know, this is a way of life in Louisiana, living on the bayou and the swamp. You know, and pretty much anyone that eats seafood, whether it's oysters, shrimp, crabs, crawfish, you know, these are people that work. You know, these are all field workers. So pretty much everyone that you know, benefits from Louisiana should take notice of this. These are hardworking people, you know, and, you know, they have nowhere to go. You know, a lot of them, it's a way of life. That's all they know. So it's devastating. And to see a storm 16 years today after Katrina yeah. is surreal.
It is.
This almost makes Katrina look like a distant memory.
Wow. For you to say it like that. I mean, considering you mentioned the hardworking people there, these are very hardy people, very resilient people. But I don't want to ask, does it get easier? I want to ask, you know, what did you learn from Hurricane Katrina that possibly helped you this time?
Well, you know, I had personal losses during Katrina. My family was in the seafood business, so, you know, we suffered a lot of losses. One thing we learned was communication is a lot better. Back then, I was working with General Honore, Russell Honore. We didn't have flip phones. All we had was flip phones. We didn't have smartphones. You know, technology has gotten so much better. You know, you got internet, you got Wi-Fi. So we have information so much better nowadays than we did back then. And one thing we learned is people are still not going to leave when they feel like they're going to lose their home. So one thing that we got to do better next time is getting the word out for people to leave soon.
Do you think they would really leave, though? I mean, there's some stubbornness around thinking, you know what, I've been through the worst of it. I can make it through this. But with the damage we've seen, perhaps the lesson is that we need to tell people to leave, but maybe give them some kind of incentive. Will they leave?
Yeah, and you know, this year we had another issue that we didn't think about until the end was COVID.
Yeah.
You know, with the COVID crisis going on, you know, where do you go? You know, and then you're picking up people that are flooded and, you know, you don't really think about the COVID protocol when you're doing that. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of issues, you know, and we're hoping that that doesn't, you know, play a part in this a little bit later on in a few weeks. But it's just a lot going on right now. You know, the way the economy is down here, it's an issue. Nobody really understands how bad it is yet. I think reality is going to hit everybody in about 3 or 4 days.
And that's typically what we see, is that we see the shock of it and then the domino effect. But you mentioned COVID. I'm sure there are a lot of hospitals that already have issues with making room for patients. Have you seen anything there? I mean, I know that you all are helping right there on the ground, but do you have any reports from local hospitals, medical facilities?
One thing the hospitals are having right now is they were already, a lot of them, understaffed. So a lot of the hospital workers, you know, had losses. You know, their house flooded or the roof came off. So a lot of them are having to call in and not be able to go to work. So with the overcrowding in the hospitals, you know, and short staff, they're really short staff now. And that's going to probably continue on into the next 3 or 4 months.
What is something that Americans right now can do for Louisiana and for those affected?
Well, you know, first of all, we always ask for prayers. You know, sometimes I think that's God's way of making the country, everybody get together. Because during a disaster, everybody helps each other. You know, nobody really thinks about anything else in the country. You know, we could go, you could go to our Facebook page, United Cajun Navy. You can go to our website, www.unitedcajunnavy.com. You can request assistance. You can volunteer or donate. We're all volunteer. Yeah. Everything goes, but just pray. That's the one thing we need, is prayers right now.
Todd Terrell, thank you so much. We appreciate you being with us and all the hard work you're doing down there in the bayou. When we come back, remembering legendary actor Ed Asner, who passed away this weekend. Just last month, he was a guest right here with Ashley. We want you to hear what he had to say about his legacy next.
Does it feel special to know that you've touched so many generations?
Well, I like gluts. And that this kind of case, I like a lot. It's nice to become established as Lou Grant.
And that was the incomparable Ed Asner with our own Ashley Banfield, just speaking about his legacy. 413 credits to his name, 60 years. We'll miss you, Ed.